Questions like this. In discussing what the essence of a person is, right, we have to go about it as follows. We have to say, for instance, the essence of a person cannot be his hand. Why can't it be his hand? Because the person perceives that he has a hand, right? Now, since he perceives that he has a hand, then the hand must be extraneous to him. Isn't that right? Isn't that true? Right? If I have a hand, that means that I, me, has something else. Then this something else is extraneous to me, right? So the me cannot be the hand. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, to use a simple example. The other question. Right. A person, let's say for instance, a person uses a hammer. Is the hammer him? No, because he uses the hammer. If he uses the hammer, so it can't be him, right? If a person uses his hand, so then there must be something, the person must be using the hand. So the real inner person cannot be the hand. There must be something, right? So therefore the essence must be the inner self, right? Okay. Now, what about when you come to the psyche?
Am I using my mind?
Yes.
You can't use
Am I using my mind? Right. And can I say that I feel that, I feel that I am psychologically, in other words, can a person say like this, my psyche now is in a bad state. If he says that, you see, then he must be something else other than the psyche. That's right.
Yeah, we said that before.
A question so is, what is he? What is he?
That's the question.
Oh, man. A person could say, let's say, for instance, you break down the psyche into different parts. The psyche has a part which the Rambam says the Rambam breaks down the man into different parts, different components. You have the appetitive, that's a part of the person. Desire, taiva, that's a part of a person. That's one part, right? On the other hand, the person has a part which is idealistic, right? He senses this part in them, right? A person has a part which is intellectual, right? He senses this too. He says, I'm using my mind. He could say, my taivas are getting the best of me. People say that. My taivas are getting the best of me. So therefore, there must be the taivas in him. Must be something else. Right? Well, he could say, I don't know if this, he could use it. But he could say, you know what I'm saying? He could say that I feel that my taiva is getting me. Right? What do you mean your taiva is getting you? How's your taiva getting you? What's you? Aren't you the taiva you? So there must be some you in there, some underlying you that's there. Right? Now the question is, what is you? Those logical mechanisms, right?
Yeah.
Now, is this him, he himself, or is this a tool which he uses?
I'm not sure what you mean by logical mechanisms.
The mind.
Right?
You can think about that, right?
You can think that
I have a logical part to myself, right? Something and then I'll think, then all of a sudden I'll go through a logical chain of thought, right? And then I'll say, oh, one second, logic tells me this, right?
Yeah.
I better not do that because logic tells me this, right?
Right.
Well, then it means you perceive there's a separate thing than the self. Than the self. Yeah, I perceive that he's using his mind. I say, well, I have to use my mind now. Does the person ever say that?
Yeah.
Well, then that means that he wasn't using his mind before, so if the mind is him, it would be an impossible thing to say. If you say that logic is the person, then you wouldn't have any illogical people. Because everything, the essence of man would be logic. So you must say that logic is something which is built in to a person. Killing it. You know what I mean? Now we said the intellectual mind, we just said, is only built in. Right? But he mentioned that the mind is always working.
What do you mean by the emotions?
The emotions are always working. Why is emotions not working?
When you're thinking it, when you're thinking
yourself.
Why
is yourself? Because the person could perceive that he has an unconscious. It means so many things. But we would say that there is a certain part there that's always working, right?
Yeah.
And definitely in the area of the mind. Right.
Let's say somebody tells you.
I haven't perceived it. It's a useless search. Right? Is it a useless search? Not so far, man. Perceive it as an extraneous thing to the self. But we're saying that you might be able to identify it in other ways, not as an extraneous entity. It's impossible.
Right, but you can see the way it functions. You can see the way, in other words, you can see the way you can observe. Let's say you can't observe the thing directly, that's for sure, because you will be doing the observing. The observer and the observee will be the same one, right? So you can't observe it yourself directly. That you can't do. But since there are memory patterns, memory traces, you can observe it that way or through others. You know what I mean? Without memory, we wouldn't be able to do it. The self cannot perceive the self. Because if we perceive the self, then it wouldn't be the self. It would be other than the self. Right? That has to be that way. So therefore, you can't perceive it directly, but indirectly you can perceive it. Like looking in a mirror. Right? You cannot see your eyes. Right? The eye can't see the eye. But the fact remains that there is a way for the eye to see the eye. You look in the mirror and you see the eye. Right? So the self, you cannot perceive it directly, but you could look into a mirror. Now the mirror that we have for the mind is would be memory. Memory would be a mirror that you have for the mind, so you could perceive it that way. Wouldn't you say?
The person who has his mind, he has a replica of what actually occurred, and through that replica he could see the self. But you can't see the self, just like the eye can't see the eye, right? There was no things in mirror you can never see, because the eye is functioning on other objects, can't function on itself.
Yeah.
Is that right? Right? But if you have a mirror, it can see itself. But it's not really seeing itself, it's seeing reflection of itself, right? Now, the mind also has reflection. The reflection of the reflections of the mind are through the memory traces. Wouldn't that be so? I mean, don't really recreate the whole, every event that went on? And through that thing, then he could, when he looks at that, he'll be able to identify where the self is. That which is affected by all these things is the real self. That thing which is, let's say you have a thought. You see a thought, wow, that's a tremendous thought, a person thinks, right? Well, let's say, for instance, he has a certain emotion. He runs after the emotion, or he keeps away from the emotion. Or he reacts to the emotion in some way. That thing which reacts to all these things is the underlying self. Hold on. Which is the prime mover in man?
That's where we started from.
The prime mover, right. That thing
which is
shot prime mover.
Yeah.
What's a prime mover?
In other words, like this. That thing which ultimately decides to make any action, any motion. And by motion we mean not only motion, physical motion, but any motion at all. Do you know what I mean? Like, let's say, for instance, that thing which says, okay, I'm going to go, I want this, you know? Right? Or that I'm going to go for this.
Personality?
That thing which maneuvers a person in one way or another, right? Isn't there an underlying thing which maneuvers a person, whether it's emotions or whether it's anything else, in one way or another? Right? There is an underlying thing there which maneuvers a person one way or another. And that thing which does the maneuvering, it was affected by all the other things before it makes the maneuver. Right?
When you say
that underlying thing must be the self.
Take
an animal. An animal is much simpler. Take an animal, right? Now, an animal has eyes. An animal has senses. Now, the senses bring all the information into the animal, and the animal makes moves based upon all the input, right? Now, if you say, what is the animal? You wouldn't say the animal is the eyes, because the eyes are only a means to get that information into the animal. You must say that what the animal is, that which, after all the information comes to it, makes the move.
There's only one thing there. The move is a reflex there.
Hmm?
It's move based upon all those things.
So he's just the reaction machine.
Right.
But him is definitely that's definitely him anyways.
Right.
Regardless, right? Right? So then we must say in regard to man, we must have a similar setup, right? In regard to man, that which is him is that's why when I said it, that which is affected by logic, affected by emotion, must be the underlying self, right? Because it works the same way. Because everything that you have, when you say, well, that my mind tells me this, what was the expression we used to prove that the mind is not the what was the best one, the one you like the best? Well, my mind tells me this, or my emotions, I have an emotion that I want this, right? So that which is affected by all these things must be the underlying self, wouldn't you say?
affected by all these things is the ultimate thing that makes the maneuver, that makes the move. That's the prime mover, right?
Factor, you know, something that
says the mind is always working, because that part is the part that's always working. Right? That's the part that's always working. It remains, it works based upon the effects of all the other parts. And that must be the underlying self, which beyond which you can't go, because it doesn't. There's nothing. That's the thing that is using everything else, right?
That thing, right? Okay, now we found the thing. Now the question is, this thing, which is the underlying thing affected by all, and which is the prime mover in man, right? Now this thing is the real underlying self. Now the question is, how can we ever figure out a prescription for this thing? Right? There's only one answer. How are we going to know how to figure out a prescription for this thing? What do we have to do? Who is the... Is what?
As its mechanism.
That's right. That's why we haven't found the nature of it. In order to know what's going to make this thing happy, see, we have to know the nature of the thing. We don't know the nature of the thing. We just identify by virtue of its action. It works. Right?
We just know its functions. We don't know its
functions. We don't know what its nature is. Yes.
Of all the... of the effects, that which is a recipient of the effects of all these things, of everything. In other words, let's put it this way. Since man is one organism, and everything in man can either serve one or two functions. Right? Either it is something either something which is used. When you say something which is used, it means it's used by something else, which means that it has effects on something else.
Okay.
Right?
So.
Like the eyes affect the mind, and it's as you keep on going. There has to be that underlying thing which doesn't affect anything else, which is the recipient of all the effects. That must be, by definition, that must be the self. Isn't that logically, mustn't
right.
that be the definition? Okay. Now we say that happiness will always be when that thing is fulfilled to the greatest degree, right? Okay, so now we have to know the nature of the thing and know how to fulfill it. What is to find happiness?
Isn't the first question you have to ask?
Whether it has the control to make that move or not is a different question. All right? We have to be cautious not to let's forget about Bechira, because we're going to be in trouble then. There's no question about that. Because the prime mover, we said, will be satisfied only by happiness. And happiness is a result of the prime mover being in its perfect state. Now, since everything seeks its perfect state, so that thing is always going to be seeking happiness. Right? That's for sure. Okay? That's for sure.
But even though it might make things more difficult, sometimes we're better off making things more difficult. Then we're closer to a solution. Wouldn't you agree? Right? Okay. Things get worse, it means that...
Doc
before what? Yes, sir. Okay. The thing is like this. That this thing, we say, has a certain nature, right? And happiness is the fulfillment of its nature, right? And it's one thing that's very odd. And that I'll say again, the question of the football player. Because it would seem to us that philosophical happiness would be diametrically opposed to physical happiness, right? In which case, the nature of this thing should be, that it's fulfilled by philosophical happiness, let us say. I'm being a little prejudiced here, but I'm assuming it's just for the case. Because really, if we want to be honest, the philosophical happiness isn't the right thing, we have to go to the other thing. Let's assume it temporarily, okay? Right. So, now, wouldn't it be odd indeed to find a thing whose nature is such that let us say its nature is to be fulfilled by philosophical happiness, and yet it will be happy at something which is the exact opposite. Do you know what I mean? And really, isn't this the problem in life? And let's understand it. Isn't the problem in life really that a person does not go... Why does a person go for the taivas and go away from the life of Torah to life of thought? Why does a person do that? Isn't it true because that part of the self has experienced happiness in these other areas? And isn't it true if he's never experienced happiness in these other areas that he definitely wouldn't be such an idiot as to go after it? But the fact remains that he has experienced happiness in these areas. And you'll tell him momentarily at times, right? But the fact remains he has experienced the happiness, correct? And therefore we say, well, he's deluding himself to think that this is the greatest happiness. But the fact remains he must have experienced some happiness. Otherwise, he would never keep on going. Nobody is that idiotic. Right?
Well, how do you know?
So therefore, isn't it odd indeed to find a thing who has such an odd nature that we say that its nature is such that it's fulfilled by two opposites? Do you know what I mean? Right? They're just different forms of gratification. Right?
Yeah.
But why do we present them as opposites? Right?
So you're presenting them as opposites, you're not looking at the happiness.
Yeah.
You're looking at the cause of happiness.
Yeah.
Well, because happiness is the same. You can't say the self that the self.
Happiness is a state that is reached through when this thing is satisfied, right? Okay. That's what we're searching for, right? When this thing is satisfied. Now, for this thing to be satisfied, you have to have a certain formula, right? You have to have a certain formula. Okay. Now, you have to have a certain formula. Okay. Now, when we take a look through life, we said that on the whole, we find there are very few people that are happy, right? And most people we would not consider to be happy, right? Rather consider them a state of unhappiness. But what's disturbing is this. So, in other words, when we say that people are unhappy, on the whole, right, so that means that they're missing the formula, right? They're missing this formula. Now, isn't it odd that even though they're missing this formula, still, momentarily, they experience this happiness? Do you know what I mean? It's as if, in other words,
yeah, if it's possible in a way, then how could they possibly
have it even momentarily?
Right, right.
In other words, the difference, they should be, momentarily would seem to be a quantitative factor. And yet, if in order to achieve happiness you need a certain set formula, which they don't have, how come momentarily they can have it? That's what I really mean. Right? A life of happiness. I think we say it that way, right? Life of life is life. So therefore we'd have to say that nobody else has happiness. Because this is a certain set life, a certain formula. It's an intricate design over there. It's not a simple thing to be a philosopher. It's a whole way of life. Right? Now, therefore, if that is the thing, then we have to say, well, this formula satisfies that thing. And this formula satisfies that object, fulfills its nature, and therefore gives them happiness, right? Then anything outside of this formula, or anything diametrically opposed to the formula, you see, not an opposite in terms of what it is, but is diametrically opposed in terms of the structure, should not be able to afford the same result. And yet we find that the football player has the same happiness. Unless you want to tell me he doesn't have the same happiness as the, it's a different type of happiness. That's a possibility. But on the surface, we would say, I mean, at this point, let's just look at it through common sense terms, though we see it now at this point, I would say that, well, they're both happy, right? So therefore, it would seem that the thing must have a very odd nature indeed. Why? Because it's something which we say requires a specific formula to fulfill it, and yet we find that, okay, you'll tell me, but the football player isn't always happy. Right? Yeah, he's not always, but how could he have it at any time if he doesn't have the formula? You understand what I mean?
Your original premise was...
Life happens to hit it at certain times, you know? And but why does he shouldn't be associated to it at all?
Yeah,
go ahead. Right? Which has a physical part. Let's take the eating. Eating's a good example. Now, what would you answer if I told you that the... that the happiness for the organism is when the organism eats. It has the physical satisfaction of tasting food, right? You would say to me, no, that's wrong. Why? Because the physical satisfaction of tasting food is only one part of the organism, right? And satisfying that part is not satisfying the ultimate self, right?
I would say that.
Well, you would, but the
yeah.
In other words, unless you would say that the whole organism, unless you're going to tell me, all right, involve a single part, right? But happiness must be the for this thing which is behind all the parts.
Then you have to say that happiness cannot be related to anything.
You see, people are thinking they're miserable. Thought isn't an exception. How many people have jobs? A job, let's see, we just told you, we force a guy to sit and learn. Very unhappy, but he's sitting alone, he's thinking. Right? So thought is no different than anything else. Right? Okay. If that is the case, so then there should be a specific formula for this thing. If this thing is a faculty like any other faculty, then there should be a formula for this faculty, right? Now, over here, there doesn't seem to be any formula for this faculty. Why? Because you'll see that a person who enjoys eating, his happiness will be when he's eating.
as if the whole happiness is involved in this faculty of eating, and not in the ultimate faculty.
What's the ultimate faculty?
The faculty behind all the faculties, and whatever this, and the happiness must be in the satisfaction of this faculty, right? Now this faculty is different than the other faculties, right? Because it's the faculty which is behind all the faculties, behind all the emotions and the reason and everything. Isn't that true?
Self.
So that's the self, right? Now there must be a specific formula for this faculty which will keep it happy, right? Okay?
Right. No.
What? Ways of doing it. But ultimately, there has to be that one formula. It must hit the same formula. All these different ways have to hit that same formula, right? There must be, if we say there's a faculty of faculties, then there must be one formula for this faculty of faculties. Now, granted that there might be different avenues of approach, there might be different activities which will result in it, but all these activities have to result in one formula. Now, the oddity is that there are so many various activities that would seem to result in that same formula. That's a very odd thing. Okay?
Everything
you have requires certain conditions. In this case, the condition is a certain activity. Right? Because we must say that happiness is an activity. It's not sleeping. Right? So it must be a certain activity. Now, the question is like this. If there is a certain activity for man that is in line with fulfilling this underlying self,
force.
Unifying force, right? Then wouldn't it be odd indeed to find that there are so many various activities, one of them will say, let's say like a philosophical one, will give the guy extended happiness. And yet the wrong activity, if we're going to say that, then the football player has the wrong activity, or the person who eats has the wrong activity. Yet he still goes experience the same quality, but not as much time-wise. But if there's one form of activity for man which satisfies this ultimate thing, right? So then there's one formula, right? So it's very odd that this one formula can be satisfied in so many different ways by different activities. You know what I mean? That's what I'm saying. It's very odd. I mean, it's like we just see that this is so. So we say, sure, there's one underlying formula. Right. If I'd like to know what the formula is, that can be satisfied in so many different ways. You must say, let's call this thing, this underlying thing, we'll call the soul, okay? All right, but the soul we do not mean in the Geish sense of soul. You know what I mean? What we mean by soul is this underlying thing, right? Okay, now this underlying self, well, we decided right now we'll call it the soul, right? This soul apparently has the ability, you see, to be affected either by to be drawn to different things. You know what I mean? It has the ability, in other words, I guess, let's say, for instance, you take the soul and you sit it down and you explain to it an idea. Not off coercion, but just an idea. You know, just like this, interested in an idea. And the soul will go, wow, that's nice. I'd like to hear more of that. See? The person says, I'd like to hear more of that. That means that underlying self is moving in that direction. Right? But if you take this self and you present it with taivas, it will also say, hey, wow, that's good. I would like to have more of that. See? So we could see one thing about the nature of this underlying soul. And that is that it can be its nature is such as it has a plastic nature insofar as it could be affected by different things, it could be drawn by different things. Right? Huh? One second. No. It could be drawn, it could be attracted by, it is in the nature of this thing to be able to embrace different things, right? Now, therefore, I say like this, that what the soul develops, the soul has to undergo a developmental stage. Much will depend on what the nature of this thing is. The nature, we ask the question, what is the nature of this underlying self? The nature of this underlying self is indeterminable. It's only determinable after it has gone through certain processes. If you take this self and you expose it to A, B, C, D, E, then it will be attracted to those things. And then its nature will, in other words, the nature of the soul is that it changes
depending upon what it is exposed to, Okay? Now, I'm not telling you, when I say exposed to, I know I'm talking like there's no bechira, but I'm just doing it that way in order to simplify matters, because it'll be much easier to understand it that way. You know what I mean? In other words, like this. It is a substance which is, it doesn't have really a form. It's an amorphous substance, which dependent upon how it is, it will take the form, in other words, its nature derives from the activities which it will be attracted to. You know what I mean?
Its nature is really defined by the...
What? That it can adopt, that it will adopt the nature of those things which it will be involved in. What? That's right. So therefore I say one thing, that the nature of the soul of the philosopher is different than the nature of the soul of the football player. Because the nature of the soul of the philosopher is one which has been attracted to thought. And to it, thought is a part of its nature, so that fulfilling it will necessarily have to be through the process of thought. Whereas the nature of the soul of the football player is such that he's been attracted by the physical things, right? So therefore, this soul will only be fulfilled by these physical things. See? If he adopts this nature, then it's going to be fulfilled by that thing. You follow what I'm saying? That, in other words, like this. If the soul is exposed to ideas, it will partake of the nature of ideas. If the soul is exposed to the physical, it will partake of the nature of the physical. Okay? Now, whatever nature it adopts, I should say, that nature, now you're going to have to satisfy that nature. That's why there are so many multifarious forms. Remember we're saying what the underlying thing is how come so multifarious? The reason why there's so many multifarious forms is because really there's so many multifarious souls. You understand? The soul being determined by what it partakes of. But its nature is such that if it is exposed to ideas, it'll partake of ideas. If it'll expose something else, it'll partake of that other thing. Now whatever it partakes of, that becomes part of its nature. You see? Now once that becomes part of its nature, you'll have to satisfy it through an activity which is in accord with that particular thing. Right? Now therefore we will say that the soul, therefore we'll say this, when we say before, it's very odd to have one thing that's satisfied by so many different things. The reason is because you don't have one thing anymore. You see, you don't have one thing, you have different souls. You see, you have the soul of a philosopher, and you have the soul of a football player, two different souls. So the truth of the matter is that the person, when you're satisfying the football player, and you're satisfying the philosopher, you're satisfying two different souls. This means, once again, we're talking about the same underlying principle? Yeah, but the nature of that underlying principle is to partake of different things, depending on what it's exposed to. Okay? That's no problem with the same guy. Because with the same guy, it's just a matter of working it out quantitatively. The soul is drawn on the one hand to this, and it's drawn on the one hand to that. Right. So insofar as it's drawn in, insofar as it's in between, it partakes of both natures to some degree. Right. Sometimes it'll partake essentially of the nature of the ideas, and sometimes it'll partake partially of the nature of physical, or it could be the other way around. As a matter of fact, that's the whole concept of tzaddik in Russia and Beinoni. That's all kinds of right there. The tzaddik gomor, and by the way, that's the concept of tzaddik gomor and tzaddik shenigom. Tzaddik gomor means where the soul is completely, it partakes of the ideas. You see? That type of a soul. Now that's tzaddik gomor. Tzaddik she'eino gomor means it's essentially the soul partakes of the ideas, but there is a part of it that's also being drawn to the physical. You see? Part of it. It's quite subject to variation of degrees. Okay? Not only is it subject to what it's going to partake of its nature, you see, but it's subject to variation of degrees within this nature. Essentially, it could be after this, but partially after something else. Okay? Yes. I wouldn't say the ideas become part of the soul. I would say its nature partakes of something of ideas, because it is akin to the nature of ideas, because it strives after it. You know what I mean? It partakes of that nature. It's a component which has something in common with that nature, just like the eye has something in common with light. You know what I mean? In that way, but you wouldn't say that the objects which you see are in the eye, you know what I mean, has something in common with the objects that it sees. Yes.
What are you saying?
They have two, that the soul, the two different types of souls, right?
And the question is, how could one soul enjoy two different activities? Right? Okay. Okay, so then we would have to say that the nature of this soul is that it's been partially developed to each way.
Right.
And therefore, it enjoys each one alternatively. Alternatively. You know what I mean? Alternately. You understand what I mean? In other words, it's been developed to perceive the good as the... It runs after the ideas and it runs after the other thing, right? So it partakes of both. Partakes of both. Exclusive, these things. They're not opposites in the sense that they're mutually exclusive. They are mutually exclusive. They're two different things. Then its nature is to partake of both.
It's not one.
See? If they're two opposite things, then you're right. They can't partake of both. The soul, right? But since they're not opposites, so therefore the soul can partake of it's learned to partake of this and that.
I think it's the physical.
Right. So therefore we'll enjoy either one. That's nature. Once it's exposed to both of these, and now its nature becomes to enjoy. Its nature will be defined. They're not. In other words, those two things aren't opposites. The let's say thought and eating. They're not opposites. Not opposites. No.
They're
opposites. They're going to have two different natures.
Yeah.
You can have two different natures in the soul. It's not opposites. They're two different things. Now, there's a certain blending that will get used to that blend. That's a blend. Now it's used to that blend, right? So that's the thing it wants. It's used to, it needs a certain blend now. There's a blend. It needs a blend of 9 hours learning, 3 hours time up. Now it's used to that blend, so therefore we'll have that blend. Whatever, that's a blend. Now the question is, when we speak about happiness, now the question is, which soul will be happier, right? For that, you have to use the proof of learning. In other words, if we could show that it is better to be a soul A than soul B, for different reasons, see, then we will show why soul A has a superior existence over soul B. And it will turn out that soul B, by becoming this form, will have an inferior existence. Because its nature, by definition, in the reality that it finds itself, will never be able to be fulfilled, except for momentary times. You see? So therefore, this soul will, on the whole of its existence, have an inferior type of existence.
Quantitatively?
Definitely. Quantitatively. Right. The quality, you can't say, because the quality is there. That's what we've shown. The quality is always going to be there, because that's its nature. You see? That's its nature. The nature is it's going to be fulfilled when you reach its nature. Now, once it's established its nature, it's going to be fulfilled. But since in the realm of reality, it's going to have certain inherent limitations, so therefore in the life existence of that soul, it will find that its existence is inferior. Whereas the other soul will have a superior existence because it will be more fortunate insofar as it has a different nature and can find more fulfillment. You see? So therefore, right, you understand what I'm saying? That's the way we work out. It turns out that an inferior soul cannot fulfill itself because of its nature. One thing you have to remember is that the soul, regardless of its nature, has the same desire for fulfillment. Right? Regardless of its nature, has the same desire for fulfillment. Insofar as it's in existence, it needs to be fulfillment. Now, it turns out that because of its nature, in many instances, it will never be fulfilled. Because it has adopted this nature. You understand? And if it follows taivas or other things, so then those things will make it happy. Right? And there's a lot of them between levels too. Right? So it turns out that the soul of a chacham and the soul of a rasha is really two different souls. That's why I can understand another thing, that the concept of Vailam Haba. See, the concept of eternity. Because basically what we say is that since the soul has the ability to assume the nature of that which it is involved in, you see, so therefore if it is involved in the abstract, so then it's not subject to destruction, because the nature of the abstract is not subject to destruction, if it's involved in chokhmas. But if it's involved in taiva, in the physical, so then the moment it dies, the moment the body dies, so then it's lost, because there's nothing... There's nothing left in its nature which is not subject to destruction. You see, right?
Okay. There's one thing that I will tell you, though. There's one thing. See, the Rambam says an interesting thing. The Rambam says an interesting thing not in the Maamar Avochim. He says it in the Sanhedrin, the Pirush Mishnayos in Sanhedrin. He says an interesting thing. He says that the Hanoa of Olam Haba is not, a person could never know what it is in this world. Could never know what it is in this world. What's the Pasuk? Pasuk on that. Pasuk. Pasuk. Because the Ayin LeRosa. Ayin LeRosa. Yeah. Ayin LeRosa. What has seen? What is in store for a person in Olam Haba? This enjoyment is not subject to division. You cannot find any mashal with which to compare this enjoyment. Okay. Novi, all of us shalom. Shalom abo eino musa b'chushim. You see, there's the little numbers. All of us shalom, right before the mem. Shalom abo eino musa b'chushim agufniim. V'zeo shinema ayin lo rosa olakim zelasecha. Here's the kol hanavim kula lo nisnabu elo li mois hamashiach. Ava Olaylam Aboa, Ayin LeRosa LeKim Zelasecha. Okay. Now, that's the Rambam. So therefore, I want you to understand one thing. So therefore, it turns out like this. I mean, according to the way we're explaining it, it turns out that whether a person will have Olam Haba or not. And this is the important thing. The one important thing is the reason why we got started on this whole thing with the neshama and the whole business was because somebody asked a question about Schar V'Einish. That was the question that was raised. What's the whole concept of Schar V'Einish? The Rambam goes out of his way. If you have time to read this Rambam, it's a very important Rambam, unbelievable Rambam. Rambam explains that the main thing is that most people have a concept that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give them a matana for doing something good. In other words, after a person's years are over, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will tell him, well, look, you did a good job, you worked very hard, and here's your matana. You see? He says this is an infantile notion. It's an infantile notion. I'll tell you something, it's an infantile notion, but it's so ingrained that I have hardly seen a person that doesn't have it. You know what I mean? Because it's from... You're raised that way. So you're raised that way from childhood. So therefore, as much as you read the Rambam and a person understands it, but it's very hard to uproot this. Because a person instinctively believes that it works, it operates on that thing and that type of level. But you have to understand that's a foolish thing, because then a Kadosh Baruch Hu would be, then this whole world would be nothing more than a Kadosh Baruch Hu tells you to do a hard job and he's paying you back. He doesn't need you to do the job, and he doesn't need to pay you back. What does he need you for? We do not help a Kadosh Baruch Hu. When a person listens to his father, so really the truth of the matter is that why does the father want the son to the father has certain investments in the son. It's an extension of himself. It's part of him. He wants to see good for the son. But he pays the son back, you see. The concept of paying him back is done as a means to get him to do that which he feels is important for the son to do, and is important for him as well. But with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I mean, it's not that way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need us as an extension of himself. You understand what I mean? So the only thing is, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't pay us back as a present for doing a job. I mean, it's not like a king. A king tells somebody to do a job. He has to do the job. As he does the job, he helps the king. We don't help a Kadosh Baruch Hu by doing these things. It's only for ourselves. So the concept over here, the underlying concept is that it's a natural process. Right? So the result is like this, that the way a person's soul is, the way a person forms his soul, and how does he form a soul? Either by following the taivas or else by following Chochmah. And whichever he follows, that determines what the nature of the soul will be. If the soul develops into an abstract entity, so then it'll remain, then it'll exist forever. And if not, then it won't, and it'll be destroyed. But it depends upon the nature of the individual. But it's not a matana, a loss of matana, loss of love. You understand what I mean? So the truth of the matter is like this: that's the basic concept. The basic concept is that it's a natural result. Schar Vaynish is a natural result. A natural result of, right, of what a person does with his Bechira. There is something else, however, also. Because you see in the Torah it says, that's what the Ram misks in Yadah Chazakah. He says, Nochas Shuvah. He says, since the real good is not the physical good, right? So he says, so if that's the case, so why does the Torah say that if you do good, I'll give you all these brachas, and they're all physical brachas, and if you do bad, I'll give you all the klalas, and the klalas are terrible physical things. If that's not the good, that's not the bad, it's a natural process. So what do you need the hashgacha for? So what's the answer? The answer is the hashgacha is there as a means to make sure that you have the ability to live correctly. Right? That's the schar. The schar is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hashgacha makes sure that the person has the ability. And if he doesn't deserve it, if he's not deserving of it, so then hashgacha is not there. Hashgacha is not there. He's subject to chance, so he's, or hashgacha is against him. Hashgacha determines that he should be destroyed. So then he won't have the opportunity, he won't have the ability to have the natural process. But essentially, it's a natural process. The other things are just means. Yes. Possible in many instances. I can't say in all instances. All instances depends on the parsha brachos and the chachma. But in many instances, you could say that the person would perish if it wasn't for the hashgacha. So therefore, you must have the hashgacha. If you didn't have the hashgacha, it would perish. But the objective of the whole world is that a person should be able to perfect the soul. And therefore, if a person, even though he perfected his soul, would still be confronted with thousands of physical problems, right? So he wouldn't be able to do it. The objective would be lost. So you can say this is the objective of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is to create a situation in which Adam can reach the perfection of Adam. Now if you guess why is that the objective of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that I can't answer already. Because that's only tied in with his infinite Chachma. See, but within the objective, you could see why it has to be that way. Right. Do you know what I mean? But you can't ask why is that the objective, right? That's right. That's why. Sorry, the famous is a rough one time mentioned a story that he said that Reb Chaim was one time in the house of I forgot who it was, another gadol, and they were waiting for him and somebody else. So they were talking. So they're looking on the shelf. I think they saw a sefer on some sefer on Ashkafa. So they took it out, opened it up. They said that looked into it. Said, "Yes, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create the world?" So why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create the world? So one said, "Because of his midah of Chesed," I think it was Chesed. You know, the other one said it was because of his midah of Kavod, Baruch Malach Alas Kvodo. Now, Chaim said neither one is right. He explains that you can't possibly go beyond a certain point. Beyond a certain point, the question... In other words, once you know that there is a thing whose nature it is to exist, and you can't ask why it exists, and this thing is the source of all Chachma, now you can't ask any question you're going to ask about the thing is going to be an illogical question. It's like asking why the thing is what it is. See? So regard to Kadosh Baruch Hu, once we know his existence, you see, once we know he exists, then you can't ask, now you can ask, now why does he do this? Anything which is tied into his, why he does this is because of his nature. Now the question is, what is that nature? Man can't perceive that nature.
When man can't perceive that nature.
That pleasure is certainly an important factor, right? Now where does pleasure belong now? Now after we went through the whole thing, where does pleasure belong in relation to this all? Let's say, for instance, a person learns. He sits and learns Torah, has tremendous enjoyment. Would you say that's a ruchniistic enjoyment or not?
It's not
a ruchniistic enjoyment. Yeah, Ram says not. Ram says that any pleasure that you have in this world is not spiritual pleasure. See? Because in this world, it always is tied in with a goof. Always. See? It's an interesting thing. It's an interesting Ram.
What?
It's not only the only place for the real ruchni, the hatayniga ruchni is olam haba, but not over here. It's an interesting thing. I mean, most people don't realize that, because most people think that there's a ruchnistic thing. No, that ruchnistic thing is a certain psychological thing. But the only thing that you can say is that ruchnius, in other words, what people define as ruchnius, or they think is ruchnius, you see, is essentially it's not really ruchni, but it is ruchni insofar as the soul is going after the proper object. You see, insofar as it affects the soul, it is ruchni. But in the nature of the enjoyment is not the same as a tiny ruchni. That the Rambam, if you go through from va'ata straight down, you'll see clearly that the Rambam leaves no doubt about it. That in this world, he says like this. He says like this. You see, take a look. Va'ata ochel. You have the va'ata ochel. Now take a look. You should know. Just like the blind man could never see color, the ain achorish masig shema kolos, and the deaf person could not know what sound is like, cannot perceive it. The loyasoris taivas hamishgo, and a person who is impotent can't know what a sexual enjoyment is. Kain lo yasigu agufos haitanugim hanefashios. Hanefashios. Therefore, the same way, the body, the physical, cannot perceive the tainug hanafshi, hanefashios. Ukimosha dogim einam yodim yisora eish, just like fish do not know about fire. Lefisha yosim yisora mayim, shame, of course, just the opposite. Kain ein no da bazer olam agufni. He says it is not known in this physical world, tainug ha'olam haruchani, that the enjoyment of the world of ruchnius. That's four lines down from va'ata ochel. Okay, avol, and he goes on. Avol ein etzleinu b'shum ponim tainug zu. We do not have this enjoyment in any manner whatsoever. Avol ein etzleinu b'shum ponim tainug zu. We do not have this enjoyment in any manner whatsoever. Zulasi tainag aguf buvad. We only have tainag aguf. It's an amazing Rambam. Tainag aguf. That's all we have. Vasoga sachushim. And the physical senses, sense perception. Min amaychal o min amishte va mishgo. The kol mashe zulasi. Eila hu etzleinu b'li matzi. Veinu makirna say. It means that you can have knowledge of, it's like a person who would be blind and you start explaining to him what sight is. So after Hakira Gedola, he'd be able to perceive somehow or other what the how it works, but he'd never really experience it. See? That's what the Rambam says. So according to the Rambam, there is no such thing as a ruchnius dick enjoyment. People make a mistake. Not a ruchnius dick enjoyment because it doesn't exist. It's a psychological thing. The only thing you can't say is a psychological thing, and just like a person experiences, other people experience in other ways. But the only thing you can say is, if there is such a thing as a ruchnius dick type of action, it's ruchnius for another reason. It's ruchnius because it is the proper object which the soul is pursuing. Right. You see? And therefore the nature of the soul is changing insofar as it's pursuing the proper object. You understand what I mean? But the actual enjoyment experienced is not the enjoyment of ruchnius. Because in this world we cannot perceive a ruchnius dick enjoyment. The Rambam makes it clear, it says it three times over here.
So, what is the definition of Shabbos?
Mein olabah means, because really Shabbos, the essence of Shabbos is that a person should be involved in thought, in chachma, in Torah. That's really the essence of Shabbos. Ramban says in the Shema v'Zohar. So the essence of Shabbos is that a person should be involved in chachma, Hashem, in Torah, and be removed completely from all the physical things. That's the whole purpose of Shabbos. Issa malacha. That's the whole purpose. That's the purpose. That's the key masay, actually, according to Rambam, Ramban. That's the purpose of Shabbos. So Shabbos is mi'ein olam haba. It means that in olam haba also, a person is removed from all the physical things and he's involved totally in Chachmas Hashem. But the enjoyment, you see, the particular enjoyment that you experience, that you feel, that's not olam haba. It's just similar to olam haba in the sense that it's completely removed from the physical and he's completely involved in the Chachmas Hashem, because that's really the purpose of Shabbos. That's why in Shabbos you have a lacha. Machlokes is allowed to play chess in Shabbos. You certainly not allowed to read magazines or read the papers in Shabbos because you're not allowed to be involved in anything that's not Chachma. Chess is a machlokes. because it's chokhmah. Because some say it's chokhmah, some say it's mutter. Letter for that. Some say it's not. But the machlokes Rambam, Rambam holds he's not even allowed to learn chokhmah chitanius on Shabbos. Even like geometry, you see, in mathematics, the Rambam holds. But the Rashba argues, Rashban and Ramban argue. We pass on Rashban and Ramban. Interesting thing. But anyways, that's why the Mechaber says that you're allowed to look into a telescope at Shabbos. Question whether it's allowed to do it. So he says, since we pass on like the Rashba and Ramban, that Chachmas Chitzenius is, if it's Chachmas Mutter, but it's not Chachmas Aser. To read a story in Shabbos Aser. Not allowed to read a story in Shabbos.
That's what
it's a reflection of Olam HaBa in the sense that it's, but not in the personal enjoyment, or the emotional experience is not the emotional experience of Olam HaBa. That's clear. That's what Ram says. That the emotional experience is a different one. Over here it's an emotional experience. Over there it's a different experience, like the Ram says. He says, Aval Einet Lenu B'Shum Ponim Tainegzu. See that? 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 lines down from Va'ata Ochel. Aval ein etzlenu b'shum ponim tainik zu. Zulasi tainis haguf bulvad. See what Ram says? Couldn't be any clearer. He said, we do not have in any manner, in any way whatsoever, we do not have this enjoyment. We only have... Then the neshama changes and is capable of existing in the Olam HaBa. If the neshama follows taivas, then it will be destroyed because the thing which it follows is subject to destruction. It's capable of assuming, it's an entity which is capable of assuming two opposite substances, two opposite entities. It's an interesting thing, like an in-between. A lot of things to understand. I mean, I don't understand what we can understand that, Sean. We do understand, we just be happy what we can understand about it. But to ultimately understand, the Rambam says one of the deepest things in one of the deepest studies. He says even great chacham went into it, they don't really know exactly what it is. Shiras and Nefesh is a big thing. But certain things we can know. So that's the way it works. But there's one thing I want to tell you. There's one thing you should know. That the thing that when we say that the neshama has bechira and the neshama of a tzaddik is different than the neshama of a rasha. Why is it different than the neshama of a rasha? Because of the way it lives. The way it lives changes it. Not the pshat that he did a mitzvah and therefore Kadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, he did a mitzvah, now you're going to get a reward. But the way he lives in Kamenei, one thing that draws the neshama. It's an interesting thing. What is that? Is one thing a jaka? Or he could be involved in the enjoyment of typhus. A tire is an enjoyment. You have to remember, a tire is an enjoyment. A tire is not the person. If a person learns, he doesn't have the enjoyment of learning. He's missing something. He has to have the enjoyment of a tire. There's a certain enjoyment there. So enjoyment is something which the neshama can be drawn either way. Drawn one way or the other way. Depending upon how we, what his bechira is, how he exercises bechira, right? Okay, that's the way it works. All right, now let's take the questions. Well, the Rambam himself, in the end of his life, had hardly any time to learn. If you ever read the letters that he wrote to his Talmud, Shmuel ibn Tibbon, so he was busy all day long, going to the king, to the sultan, and then came home. There were lines of people waiting for him. He said, the only time he had, he gave a little shiur on Shabbos, I think he says over there. Right? So he wouldn't even have time to talk to him if the guy came. 24, he ate one meal in 24 hours. One meal a day, that's all he ate. And he really, what? Yeah, so he really exhausts himself at the end of his life. So the question is, what about learning? Why didn't he learn? Why didn't he learn then? If learning is the most important thing. The answer is what? Yeah. The answer is that ultimately, you see, ultimately a person's ultimate chiyuv is Avas Hashem. Avas Hashem means... Now, when a person reaches a certain level of Avas Hashem, so then he has to do what the purpose of the world is. Kadosh Baruch Hu's purpose in the Bria. He has to partake, even if it means sacrificing his own learning. But he's not losing in terms of perfection, because that's what perfection demands. So you have to know when and where. I mean, a guy that's not in yeshiva, a guy shouldn't do something, a guy shouldn't learn it. But for certain times, a gadol, in a certain situation, might have to forfeit his learning. Look at Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, I mean, I'm sure he could have learned more without spending time with all the shallow things bothering him, right? Ah, but that was a chiyuv. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu really didn't want to assume it to begin with. He turned down being the leader of Klal Yisrael. But he had to do it because of Avas Hashem demanded that he does it. Justice demands that he does it. A person who does that, a person who supports somebody else to learn Torah at a tremendous level of justice. So even though he can't, learn himself, so he can't actually partake of the ideas himself, but there certainly is a tremendous level of Avas Hashem. No question about that.
But is it true that if his soul is...
And when does he eat the teif come? When he's bar mitzvah. An interesting thing. Most people look at the opposite way. They think a little kid is he eats the teif, you know?
Okay.
Morris is the opposite. An innocent kid, right? Morris is just the opposite. A kid is he eats the hara. See? Why is that so? What?
Why? He gets everything he wants.
Ram explains. Yetzer hara means when the person is just an instinctual force. That's yetzer hara. Instinctual forces. See? The child is nothing more than instinctual forces. When a person, when he reaches bar mitzvah, then he could start reflecting and say, one second, this I won't do, that's wrong, this I want to do. That's already yetzer teiv. See? But before, when he's in his childhood, he doesn't have any bechir. He has no choice. So he just follows his instincts. See? Follows his instincts, that's Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara's instincts. Might be nice instincts. You know, even the Gemara says any emotion that a person has could be Yetzer Hara. Even Rachmanis, tremendous emotion, Rachmanis, that could be the worst Yetzer Hara. Call him Racham al Azor, Seifay Nasa Azor Rachmanim. Because a person that has Rachmanis in the wrong time, it's very Rachmanis in the wrong time, so it's Racham on Russia. Racham on Russia can destroy other people. So you see, any emotion, any instinctual force is Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Tov is the control of the instinctual force. That's the Yetzer Tov, right? That's the Yetzer Tov. That's what the from the Gaon I want to mention. From the Gaon says, why does it say Ata Yadati Kirei Lekim Ata by Avraham Avinu? So Lecha Sachta Zbincha Sichidecha. He says because the truth of the matter is Avraham Avinu was always a big was a big Baal Chesed. He says so maybe you'll say that the reason why it was Baal Chesed was a nice guy, he had nice emotions, very nice, kind person. So that's nothing. That's just I'm born that way. People with teva are kind. That's not godless. Godless is when he overcomes his emotions in order to do what is right. Whether his emotion wants to be more merachim or the emotion wants to be more achzori, doesn't matter. But to overcome. So he says, now that I see, that was a test. He says with Yitzchak. That he was able to kill his own son. So he was able to kill his own son. So then you see that the reason why he did all these things before was because of control. But he had not because he didn't have the ability to be an achzar. You see? Now there's the chovash, you say it in tefillah, you say it really in tefillah rashon. The chovash is bincha lasais, Chovash Rachamav. So he conquered his Rachmanis. Chovash Rachamav, Lasesh Seinecha. That's what the Besa says. And which one in Zechrenes, right? Zechar Bris. Zechrenes. Zechrenes. Control the emotion. That's the Eitz Tov. The Dasa Odom that can control and say, now this is the right time to do this, is the wrong time. Shmuel Navi took Agag and split him in half. That was the right thing to do at that time. Rachmanis at that time would have been an Avera, would miss him. No, the person has to know the right thing. Shal Rachmanis, and then later he killed that knife here, kind of. Because it means one emotion, once he has an emotion over here, then the other time the emotion goes against him, he goes the other way. Ram and Urov, so Chazal say that the Yetzahara has a head start, 13-year head start. You know? So I was, so he's really 13 years. So who cares? I mean, I was wondering about the Gemara. So who cares? Has a 13-year head start, and now he's 15. So what's the difference if he had a 13-year head start or not? I mean, what was the head start? Chazal say. What's the answer?
Now he was actually going for his taiva.
It means the instincts have already been trained from early youth to go for the taivas, because the person until he's 13 is an instinctual being, an instinctual organism. Since he's instinctual, so he always goes for the tithes. Now, all of a sudden, he has the Eitz HaTov, right? But the paths, the patterns have been set already. Now he has to undo those patterns, remove himself, totally go against his whole nature, the patterns that have been set up already. That's why it's difficult. That's the battle. See? The patterns have been set. Now you have to remove them. That's the difficult. That's the Mechamas Chaim. That's what it is. Thing, not extraneous thing. It is over there. What is Yemaisa Mashiach? Okay? Whether all of them are Yemaisa Mashiach or not. That's the Machlagas. You understand what I mean? In other words,
whether Olam Abba, everybody agrees that Olam Abba, no one knows what it is. But the question is whether you must, since he defies the Moshe Shech Olam Abba, so you see the Olam Abba and Moshe Shech are two things. That's the Gemara there. So Olam Abba and Tchias HaMesim, he says there will be nothing unusual, nothing will change, he says, and people will die again. They'll die again. He says the Tzaddikim will come back, and then they'll die again. It'll be a regular world. So it'll just be the only. There'll be no difference practically. The only difference will be that the memshala of the Melech HaMashiach will go on for a very long time. You know, not he himself. He'll die, but his children, through his offspring.
He didn't say anything about whether the world will.
But nothing unusual. There's nothing unusual will happen here. And Ramban says that the whole thing will be different. He says the person won't have to eat, he won't have to sleep, because the Gemara says, "Ein bein olam hazeh olam ha." I mean, olam haba is that ein bein olam ma'achov olay mishtev olay yeshiva olay amida. So it's not a physical thing. So that's why the Rambam argues. Rambam says that there can't be any goof if that's the case, because nothing exists without a purpose. And if there's no reason to stand or sit or eat, so what do you have to have a stomach for? What do you have to have different parts of the goof? No need for it. See, so they have a Kodesh Baruch Hu never creates a situation in which you have something that has no purpose. That's why the Rambam says there's no such thing as Melechas Avtola. Kodesh Baruch Hu does not do anything for no reason. So if there's any part of the body that exists, it has a purpose. Contrary to what the lot of medical scientists used to say. You know, that there's certain parts of the body that are vestiges. No such thing. Anything that exists has a purpose, yeah. Right, that's right.
The
Ramban says there will not be any b'chir. Ramban says in the Chumash, there will not be any b'chir anymore after Olam Haba. He says naturally people will do that, which is good. The desire will not be anymore for the taifas, but it'll be naturally for Torah mitzvahs. That's what it'll be for. Naturally go there. It won't be the b'chir. That's what Ramban says. But the thing is, Machlekes, the Ram does all that. The Ramban holds that it'll be a totally different scene. So, it'll be a totally different scene. The Rambam says no, that this world will remain the same way. The only thing is that the Tzaddikim will come back, Tchias HaMesim, then they'll die again, and they'll exist in Olam Haba, which means after Misa, which is the state that they're in, where any person is in after they die.
That's the Rambam.
What's
the
Tachlis? What's the ultimate purpose?
Yeah.
The ultimate purpose is to exist in that way. In other words, what is a person striving for? It's a good question. What is a person striving for? A person strives for what? What is he doing it for? What's the answer? Best possible way. That's what you're striving for.
Okay,
you're striving for one thing. You're striving to exist in the best possible way for you as a being. That's the only thing you can be striving for. There's nothing else to strive for. What else should a person strive for? Yeah. What's that? Even that which is necessary. Achila, a person eats. But the moment a person enjoys the food, the enjoyment of the food causes him to, draws him towards the taiva. Hey, this is good. See, the interesting thing about Adam is, that man is one thing, that he makes value judgments based upon the way he enjoys things. That's the mistake. He enjoys something, it tastes good, it senses good, he says, this is good.
Yeah.
I mean, one second. Tasted good, but you can't say this is good yet. But that jump, he makes that jump. See, the moment that the senses are satisfied, he immediately places a value judgment on it. And he says, this is good. Now, once he does that, then he goes after that. That's when he says, this is good. Here we go. See? That's the way it works. So that's why really every taiva that a person indulges in, even a necessary taiva, takes away from his neshama, ultimately. Takes away, because let's say he had to eat. Well, while he ate, he enjoyed it, right? And when he enjoyed it, he immediately said, this is good. Right? This is good? That's the thing to go for. See? That's what, of course, the Rambam says that a person, unless he eats, the person shouldn't eat at all, should not take into consideration at all the taste of food. So you should only eat for health, for no other reason. Rambam, Yalachazaka says that he should only eat for the purpose of health, and that should be his diet, just what is healthy. Ask the doctor, what should I have now for lunch? I have lettuce, tomato, yeast. it's like a kelev and a chamor. So he says, no difference. It's ridiculous. It's not crazy. How do you get over it? When a person is suited itself as a mitzvah, On the contrary, so it should be more related to the ideas, not the less. It's not the bums thing. It's the guy. See, we're very influenced by the Goyim. But see, you have to remember that we live with the Goyim, and as much as you feel you're apart from them, you are affected by them. Because what's their idea? What's their idea of a yontif? I mean, a lot of what's not a yontif? What's their idea? Get drunk. And now live for the tithes. See? That's the thing. Our idea is Yadis, exact opposite. Shabbos. Who would ever think that Shabbos is a good time? Shabbos, what kind of time? What do you mean? Yisrael Malacha, Chiv, Tfilah, Talmud, Terah, in the Kiddush, Avdolah. Hundreds of Chiyuvim all of a sudden fall upon the guy. Meir Bracha. Suddenly the guy becomes burdened with many, many things that he didn't have all week long. That's a vacation. What kind of thing is that? Yantif. I mean, every yantif is chiv and mitzvahs. There's no the samachta b'hagecha. Yeah, samachta b'hagecha is also a chiv. The chiv is that a person is not allowed to worry. It's on the contrary. He can't even worry if he wants to. Not allowed to. Samachta b'hagecha. Worse. It's not a time of freedom. It's a time. It's a controlled time. A time when a person reaches perfection. We don't have any vacations like they have. Different kind of different concept. Okay. Why with them? So that's why I say sudas mitzvah. Sudas mitzvah is on the contrary. It's on a higher level than a regular suda. But we're not accustomed to that, because we think of a wedding. A wedding is a time to a person to get drunk, yeah, to go break out the tithes. That's not the way. That's not the way. The soul, the neshama. If we could speak, let's speak of, again. I'm not saying this scripturally. I'm speaking in terms of energy. See, the neshama has a certain amount of energy that it has to satisfy. You see. Okay, you understand? I'm trying to make it into type of a marshal. A certain amount of energy has to satisfy. Now the thing is like this: the tithes inherently will never satisfy it, because the tithes cannot give it enough. Because you see, a tithe, a physical thing by its very nature, requires a certain situation and a certain conditions. It's limited inherently because it's physical. It's limited inherently. Let's say, for instance, a person likes to play basketball, right? Now, there's a certain amount of time a person could play basketball. In order to get the court, he has to have work for a certain amount of money until he could put together the court in the backyard, right? And then he has to get the people together. So therefore, you see, the physical tithes are inherently limited by time and space. Since there's an inherent limitation, so you have to realize the soul has a tremendous amount of energy, which is always demanding satisfaction. And in the physical tithes, will never be able to achieve it. You see? It'll inherently never be able to achieve it. That's why it's always going to be unhappy. But in the world of Ruchnius, which is not limited to the physical, see, but inherently by nature it's not limited to the physical, the enjoyment is a constant one. That's why in that area he will always enjoy himself. See, a person who's in the world of Chachma, in the world of Torah, will constantly always have enjoyment. It will be in proportion to the way his soul is constructed. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu constructed the soul in that way precisely. You see, that it will not be satisfied by anything else, because nothing else could ever use up the amount of energy that it needs to satisfy it. You understand? What? Everything on high level doesn't stop. Keeps on going. Keeps on. You know what I mean? This is his whole life is constantly in learning. Constantly. Yeah. All the parts of the human being. The psyche gets tired of doing the same thing after a while. The same thing. You know? And it wears out. Because it can only offer a certain amount of enjoyment. You know what I mean? Even if a guy could play. You ever say, well, how come people don't really do it? The answer is because the psyche, the person, there's only a certain amount of enjoyment in this activity which he can derive out of it. Now after a while he gets bored. He gets tired of just dribbling the ball around. You know what I mean? So therefore, it's not in line with his nature. There is nothing in the physical world which is in line with a person's nature that could satisfy him. That's why, and the biggest proof is one. There's one proof that will demonstrate it quickly. The biggest proof is that the person, anyone who's involved in the physical world, always is involved in fantasy. He's always planning for the future. You see? He's planning. Now, what's going to be next? You made a certain amount of money. What's the next plan? The next thing. And why does he have to have a next thing? He needs the next thing because he hasn't absorbed, he hasn't used, if a person was more simcha at one moment, he wouldn't have enough energy to think of the next thing. Do you understand what I mean? When a person, for instance, is really at a certain time in a person's life, sometimes he can be totally absorbed in an enjoyment, right? When that moment, he can't think of the future because there's no energy left to think of the future. You understand what I mean? Now, since you see that the people who are involved in the physical are constantly thinking of the future, you see one thing clearly. That they definitely are not, that's right, they're not happy in the present. That's the nature of the thing.
in any taifa, no matter what it is, until a guy comes to the end of the line. When a guy comes to the end of the line, like for instance, I mean, a guy like Carter, starting up becoming more famous, no way, until the end, until the presidency, right? Now, after the presidency, it's not the pshat, he's not going to think of the future anymore. He will think of the future, but there's no more future. So therefore, when he's going to need that future, he's going to go into a state of depression. That's why they have a big problem. Once a person steps down from the presidency, very difficult, because they're going into a state of depression, because now their whole life, there's no more. That's the end of the line. And the energy wants to be satisfied, and there's nowhere to go, and that's it. You see? So that's what happens. With the physical, inherently in the physical, there is not enough to satisfy the neshama. See? There's only one thing. The neshama is constructed in a way that there's only one thing that will satisfy it. And that is chachma. That's it. Ram doesn't say exactly mahu racham afatah racham. Ram says, mahu nikro racham afatah haye racham. Mahu nikro chanan afatah haye chanan. So it's a metaphor. He's called Rachum, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have an emotion of Rachmanus like we have. If you say that, that's tantamount to Kfirah. Because he's saying that he's saying first of all, he's denying Hashem Echad. There's Hashem, and then he has this feeling in him. You see, and the feeling controls him. That would be tantamount to Kfirah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the feeling of Rachmanus that we have is completely alien to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He doesn't have that. That's a human characteristic. It comes from human psychology. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is different. There's nothing in common between him and us. Totally different. So, in essence, nothing. So therefore, when we say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Rachum, the Rambam explains what it means. It means HaKadosh Baruch Hu does certain actions which we would call Rachum. He does certain actions which, if we would see somebody do that, we would say that he's Gomel Chasadim. You understand what I mean? We would say he's truthful. But that, in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, doesn't stem from the same source. See? In human beings, there's an emotion for the action. There's an emotion that goes together with the action. But not in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when a person responds to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he can't have that idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has this emotion of Racham. So, Valachta Bidrachov, when it says Valachta Bidrachov, Unklus was the one that went out of the way, the Rambam explains, to always show that the nothing in the regard to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is physical. Always. He says Valachta Bidrachov, so what does Unklus say? Uncle says you should go in the drachim that are right before him. Archim the Yashrin Kadamahi, I think it's Russian. That you should follow the ways that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says are right, not the drachim of his ways, meaning that just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that you're following HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Mahu Racham Afatayeh Racham is Valach B'drachov. Uncle says Valach B'drachov is not that you should go in his ways, do what he does. Can't. It means you should go. Follow the ways that are right in front of him. Those ways which he tells you are right. That's for Drachov. You understand? His ways that he chose for you. That's what Drachov means. Not the ways that he does. That's the ways that he does. You can't do. What are we doing in yeshiva? Question like that. So does he enjoy the physical more when he has restraints? Or does he enjoy the physical more when he lets himself go completely, involves himself completely in taivas? That's the question that we're asking. If it wasn't for Torah, if he wasn't keeping the Torah, he'd be having such a good time. Back of his mind, he always has this fantasy. At the what? Front of his mind. That if it wasn't for these halachas, like some people have, depends on different cases. Some people, think that way, if it wasn't for that, and then some people have daydreams that maybe they'll find that they're a guy, Same type of thing. What would I do if I found out that I was a guy for a day? Found out I was a guy. Would I become a Jew? I do. I mean, maybe I'd come back, but first few months, let's talk about that first. See? So a person, apparently, since people have this fantasy, and it always, something that always, always plagues them to some extent, we should really analyze whether this is a mere fantasy or whether it's a reality. It tells us that if you do this, you're going to be very happy. You do it, you find out you're not. So you can't go by the emotions. The only thing we use is the mind to analyze and to see whether it's true or not. So let's put the mind to work on this question. It's a good question. It's impossible, right? But we're saying our question is, because candidate excuse is no enjoyment, but our question is, is there a point where a person will enjoy life more, even though there's an element of restraint? And it's an odd possibility, but let's take a look into it and see if it's true. Let's say enjoyment means total removal of restraints, and a person just goes wild, just enjoys himself. And any restraint is an inhibition; it's an opposing factor, right? If it's an opposing factor, so this factor should reduce the enjoyment, right? So actually, superficially, we should say that restraint is a negative factor. If it's a negative factor, so then it would reduce the enjoyment. But even though superficially we should say that way, maybe we should look into it a little more deeply and see perhaps what the situation is. Okay? All right. Now the question is, how do we go about analyzing a problem like this? Remember?
Okay. Yeah.
The question revolves, this question, this theoretical question, whether a person lives a restricted life is losing or not, revolves around one thing. Revolves around, what does it revolve around? The question. Revolves around one thing. Namely what? And whether reality can afford the person, whether in reality a person can satisfy his pleasures, his desires. Whether pleasure can satisfy the desires of a human being, that's the question. Can the pleasures in the world really satisfy a human being's desires? That's the question. Right? Okay. Why does it break down to that? How does it work? Later, we have to understand how a person is made up in regard to the world. Can a person's desires, his need for pleasure, be satisfied in the world? That's the question. Now, even though, I want you to understand something, you have to be careful. This area, you have to be careful. Why? Because everybody is always sure about these things because he has a certain feeling inside of him. He's sure that the world can satisfy his desires, you see? But you have to be careful about that feeling because that might just be a feeling. Just like when a person first starts driving a car, he's sure that he's going to enjoy this endlessly. You see? He ascribes to this enjoyment to eternity. But the fact remains that that's only an emotion. Later he finds out that he gets tired of that. And every single emotion that a person goes through, he always assumes that this is something he's going to enjoy, right? Okay. Now, the question is, once again, can the pleasures be satisfied? Can a person really have a life of pleasure, right? All right, now if you say he can, then fine, restrictions are there. But what happens if you say he can't? And we'll soon see, we have to decide which way it is. But let's say that a person cannot really satisfy his need for pleasure in this world. Right? In other words, he'll always have desires. His desires exceed their capacity for satisfaction. Okay? Alright. Then let's see. Then what happens to the unrestricted man? The unrestricted man is one who has all the pleasure. What happens? Yeah, right. Not only want to be satisfied, it means once he indulges completely in these pleasures, if these pleasures can't satisfy him, what's going to happen? He's going to have nothing. Right? In other words, let's say, for instance, a person reaches the peak. He has in his mind the peak that he could reach. Right? The peak is he'll become president of the United States, right? Now, let's say, for instance, this dream is realized. Now, if the dream can satisfy the desire, that's one thing. But let's say it can't satisfy the desire, what happens? The man must remain hopelessly unhappy. Right? Now, I want to understand one thing. Is he worse off than a person who didn't satisfy his desire or not? Let's understand. Is he worse off than a person that didn't satisfy his desire or not? What do you say? Oh, well, I'll tell you the question. That question boils down to one thing. What does it boil down to? What does it boil down to? See, fantasy is an enjoyment too, isn't it true? Okay? Fantasy is an enjoyment as well. But fantasy is not an enjoyment which is total. Because if it was total, then he wouldn't want to remove himself from the state of fantasy. He just fantasized. The fact that the fantasy wants reality shows that the fantasy isn't really the end of the pleasure. But fantasy has an element of pleasure in there because he imagines a certain enjoyment. Right? Okay. Now, the person who has experienced the pleasure and the pleasure has not given him satisfaction because he has not been restrained, isn't it true that he has no fantasy anymore? He can't fantasize anymore? Right? Okay. In other words, a person who has reached a point where the pleasure, he's unrestricted, so he's gotten the ultimate pleasure out of life, right? Now, if that ultimate pleasure can't satisfy him, isn't it true that he doesn't have anything more to fantasize about? He's hopeless. Whereas the person who never reached that has the fantasy, at least. Correct? Okay? All right. I'll say that the person who has not achieved the satisfaction
will, in the long run, have more pleasure. It is possible that he will have more pleasure than the person who has. Why? Because the one who has, right, in, or let me put it this way, after he has reached that state, he certainly will be in a state of greater pain than the one who hasn't reached that state. Why? Because when the guy has reached that state, he has neither the pleasures anymore, nor has he the fantasy, the pleasures of fantasy. Whereas the person who hasn't reached that state, it is true that he doesn't have the pleasure itself, but at least he has the pleasure of fantasy. Right? In other words, that eventually the pleasure wears out.
Oh, okay.
Right? So therefore he doesn't have the pleasure anymore, and now he has nothing to fantasize because he's unrestricted. Isn't it true unrestricted by definition means that he's reached the ultimate? Now if that ultimate, once he reaches that ultimate, there's nothing there, right? In other words, after he has that pleasure, it wears out. Like he imagines it's going to be it's going to last forever. But after a while, he's reached the ultimate. No pleasure there, right? Okay. What do you say about that, Mark? Pleasure. It's not the greatest. He has some pleasure, right? But the but this might be greater than the other guy's pleasure. The other guy has fantasy, right? Okay. Hey, in other words, we're using the person as an example. We're saying a guy who has reached a person. What drives a person out of a certain fantasy is going to have a certain pleasure, right? Now, who is better off? He who has reached that fantasy, converted that fantasy, the big fantasy, the biggest one of them all, converted into reality, right? And the other guy who didn't, right? But still has a fantasy. Right? That's the question. Ultimate. It's true that he doesn't have the fantasy anymore, but he has a certain amount of pleasure. Whereas the other guy has so maybe they're both equal, or we can't tell, right? Okay, that's a good argument. What do you say to that? The latter. Go, Bob. I think Bob has a good point. Go ahead. Yeah, it's on the rungs.
First, he has nothing back to look. He has nothing. He knows all the rest of them are ridiculous.
That's right.
So he can't look back.
He has no fence. He has no future.
Exactly right.
That's right.
Okay? That's a good point. Now, the ladder, when the guy's moving up the ladder, each one, he doesn't look at the ultimate one at first. At first, he looks at the one that's above him, right? And he feels that this is going to give him the total satisfaction. But then when he gets there, after that dissipates, then he even goes up to the next one, right? Now, as the guy's going up the ladder, right? So every time when it wears off, he has another one to look forward to. So he has at least he has the enjoyment of the imagination, right? The anticipation. But when the guy reaches the top rung, when that one wears off, then there's no more fantasy left. So it comes out that on the top rung, he has less pleasure. He has less pleasure on the top rung than the guy does on the lower rungs.
Yeah. Why?
Right? Because at least the guy in the lower rungs, once it wears off, he has the next rung to look up to. So he has the fancy of the next rung. But the guy who reaches the top rung, when that wears off, so then he has nothing. He has nothing in the future. So therefore, he's worse off than the guy that's on the lower rung. So it'll come out.
No, that can't maintain itself either.
Because there's no reason to maintain that the next rung is any better than the first rungs. Right? So therefore, when he reaches the last rung, so he's in worse shape. He's worse off. In other words, the guy that is really the guy that's getting more pleasure out of life is the senator that's driving to be the president. But the guy who becomes the president has less pleasure out of life. Because, you understand what I mean? Because once he gets used to that, then there's nothing left.
That's why you would have to be very happy.
Okay?
I'll
say that. Is that your argument? That one,
yeah.
In each step, he always felt that this step is the, all he wants is this step, right?
Yeah.
And why should the last step be any different than that?
So you're saying he has no basis for believing it, but let's say, for instance, isn't it true, like, if a guy's...
fantasizes about the next rung, why do the guy only fantasize about the rung ahead of him?
That's not true. Some guy's
going... Yep, the guy's getting a little more pleasure.
That's right.
But it's just the fantasy.
Sure, what experiment can we use to know whether this is so or not? There's one experiment that can be used to know whether what he's saying is true or not. What's the experiment? The question is, does the guy strive from the second rung, let's say from the second rung to the third rung to the fourth rung, right? Is the striving from the second rung to the third rung is equally as intense as from the third rung to the fourth rung? Or from the fourth rung to the top?
Then
it would seem to show that his argument is false.
Why?
Very simple.
That's
really dissatisfied in each situation.
Right.
I'm going to say, if the man striving in each rung is exactly equal, then it would definitely show that he's equally dissatisfied in each situation.
Right? Now, because if there was a certain amount of pleasure achieved in every rung, so then that pleasure you'd have to reduce, you have to deduce that pleasure from the remaining drive, because that was satisfied already. Right? But if the striving in each step is equal, then it would show that in each step he's equally dissatisfied. In that case, when he reaches the top, he would be he would be worse off than he was in the bottom. Okay? Top, he would be he would be worse off than he was in the bottom. Okay?
Certainly you notice that bit of difference is imperceptible, correct? Okay? Or at least it's very small, right? But how much energy goes into the fantasy of the next round? That is certainly a perceptible difference. Correct?
So therefore we could see definitely, perceptibly, that the guy in the higher rung has to be worse off. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, let's say that Bull says, how are you going to tell? Maybe he ran a little bit less for the next rung than he did for the first rung, right? Ah, that might be true, but certainly you have to agree that that difference is minimal. Right. Or at least it's not that perceptible, right? But now let's take a look at how much energy goes into the fantasy of going into the next rung. Yeah. Isn't that the perceptible quantity? Because you see the guy's whole libido's in there, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, in the balance, the guy in the top is going to lose. Because we see that he lost the perceptible quantity,
yeah.
Right?
What perceptible quantity?
The fantasy. Right. Because how much energy is involved in the fantasy? Tremendous amount, right?
Yeah.
Ah, now that amount he lost on the top rung. And there might be an imperceptible difference that he gained, right? Well, certainly he has to lose them. Perceptible quantity, he gained an imperceptible quantity. So certainly he has to lose that in the long run.